I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm here with Kay Cordell Whitaker. Welcome, Kay.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
And you have written a book called Sacred Link, Joining Fortunes with the Unknown. You have written also an earlier book called The Reluctant Shaman.
Yes.
Can you tell us about your process? How did you come to this path? I mean, you're from Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. and you were a housewife before you met the Peruvian. They're Peruvian, are they?
Yes.
The Peruvian shaman, it was a couple?
A couple, an older couple, Damano uh-huh. and Chia Hetica.
Hetica. And is that the name of their tribe or tradition, or it's just a...
That's the name they called themselves.
Okay. So tell us about your process. How did you come to shamanism from, well, I suppose being a housewife in Santa Cruz is sort of a shamanic path in itself. But
well, they say just about anything can happen or be seen in Santa Cruz. And,
yes.
And that sure is true. It is a curious place. And I had just moved there.
From?
I grew up on the other side of the bay.
Oh, where?
The Pacific Grove, Carmel
mm-hmm.
area.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I was born and raised.
Mm-hmm.
And traveled around with my husband and two children, job to job.
Mm-hmm.
We got divorced about that time, and I moved to Santa Cruz with the kids to go back to school full time.
Oh, at UC Santa Cruz?
UCSC.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to study there?
My first major was science.
Ah.
I was very conservative, very middle class, not expecting to move down this road in life at all.
Surprise!
Complete surprise.
Right.
When I met them, literally, it just turned me 180 degrees.
Uh-huh.
I just never, ever expected anything like that to happen in my life.
So, and what branch of science were you interested in studying? Or is there a branch? Just science in general, or...
I was just going to study all of them to begin with, and then narrow down.
See what
astrophysics.
Oh.
That has always intrigued me,
mm-hmm.
and the more I found out about quantum physics, that got me even more.
Uh-huh.
But as soon as I reached the higher levels of mathematics, it became quite clear to me that this was not going to be a profession. That I needed to change
okay.
my major.
Yeah. Yeah,
that it's a great thing to try to keep on top of and study, but I just didn't have what it takes to do the extraordinary math.
Oh, yes.
To back it up, to
right.
go behind it.
Right. So then you met these amazing people.
I met Damano and Chia Hetica.
Mm-hmm.
That began in about 74.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Damano first on the cliffs, Santa Cruz. And when I first moved there, I was living in a little tiny cabin kind of a house way up in Lompico in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And they had one of those storms of the century where there was actual lightning. It just doesn't happen in that area, the country. We don't get big storms, you don't get big wind, you don't get lightning.
Mm-hmm.
So here it was. Huge waves coming all the way up the cliffs onto the walking paths and into the parking lots and lightning everywhere. So I borrowed a truck because I didn't have any vehicle of my own and found a babysitter. And off I went down to the cliffs. I just had to go and be out in the middle of it. Cold, wet, probably very dangerous, but I had to be there. So I pulled up into the parking lot that's near the lighthouse, if you remember the little lighthouse
yes.
area. No one was on that road, on the ocean.
Well, it was storming.
Oh, I was the only crazy person out there. No one was in the parking lot. I got out of the truck. I went and stood out where the waves were actually, you know, coming up, and then I could get splashed by them right in the wind. The wind was just coming face on. There was lightning, you know, all around. And then this seemed quite huge at the time, but when I saw him later, he was little. He, like, came barely to my chin. this a man, dark skin, grayish hair, kind of long. He was in what I thought were white peasant clothes, Mexican style, you know, we draw pants and all that. They were kind of popular back then. And he was muddy and very wet and walking very rapidly towards me, right down the path. And when they got close enough, I could hear him in broken English, big accent. He was saying things like, "Boy, do I have something for you." I thought, oh, no. No. At that time, if you remember, there were a lot of homeless people that lived under bridges, on the beach, a lot of drugs, alcohol problems, and some real dangerous drugs where people would get, you know, frantically speeded up and just crazy, just psychotic. And I thought, he must be one of those. And whatever it was he had, I really didn't want it. So I ran back to the truck and hopped in and, you know, quickly locked all the doors and drove off. And when I shook all that off, I just kind of forgot about it. I just really didn't give it. I was disappointed that my storm adventure was interrupted and cut short. But other than that...
Oh, because this man showed up.
Yeah, and I ran away.
Ah, okay.
But other than that, it just kind of slipped out of my mind. I didn't think of it again for quite some time. And later, I was up on the campus in one of those little coffee shops, Stevenson Coffee Shop, okay. Actually. And they have great big glass windows that look out into a little court. There was a little... table and chairs out there. So in good weather, you could sit out there in the sun.
Right.
Nice little garden. And there was a big wind that came and kind of turned over a chair or the table or something. It banged right up against the window. Mm. And I looked up from, the book that I had, my coffee. That was my sanctuary time when I had the free hour away from kids and other duties,
right,
and stuff.
Right.
That's where I went and had a coffee and just did whatever it was, a book or journaling or something that was restorative. Well, I looked up at the window and there was this little man, same guy, on the inside this time, very dry, clean looking. And now he's got this huge smile, kind of a goofy smile, like there's something mentally not all together. And he's just staring at me and staring at me. And that scared me to death. If you remember the Santa Cruz campus, you can't drive up in there.
Right.
There's no place to park. You have to walk. You have to walk through the forest on these little paths. It's very beautiful, but if you're afraid of being attacked, this is a great place to be attacked on these tiny little paths. So I was scared to death of this man. And it's not very logical because he was full wrinkles, a lot of white hair. He was obviously quite small. Didn't seem to, mentally have everything together. And finally he got up and walked to my table. And he's shaking and he's got like palsy and limping. And then I thought, I've been thinking these really nasty, bad things about this poor little old man. And he obviously has a world of troubles and I misjudged him. And I felt really, really guilty, really ashamed of my own thoughts.
Well, but nevertheless, in our culture, when a stranger approaches, at least in the United States, it's in our culture to kind of go, well, who's that person?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be suspicious, yeah, paranoid even. The way I was brought up, very conservative, very, very middle class, proper. You don't talk back to older people. You're not rude to them. Especially don't talk back to men.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found myself totally incapable of saying anything to him, like, "You're not invited to my table." He just helped himself to the chair and sat down. And I just couldn't put it together enough to say, go away. You know, you frighten me, pick another table, leave me alone. I couldn't manage it to make anything come out of my mouth. So he started again with his broken English, saying how he had something for me. He and his wife had something that he said belonged to me. He had the stories, the way of living and knowledge of his tribe that he wanted to pass on.
Had you had any leanings toward the study of anthropology or...
Curiosity.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I never did take very many courses there. A lot of them involved a lot of really boring, dry reading. The kind of anthropology that you have to go through to get degrees in it, but it's really dry. I mean, just sort of meaningless.
Well, it's not boring. Alive.
Yeah, it's...
So anyway.
Just plain boring. So my idea of something interesting is the real people and the real stories, the way they think that's different, ceremonial things. But I'd never pursued anything up to that point in that direction. I really expected to go to school, to get... you know, some kind of degrees where I could pursue a career, support my kids, that kind of thing. And he's inviting me to go to his home, to listen to his stories, to let his wife and him teach me, show me. And I'm thinking to myself, no way, never, ever. I'm not walking alone to a stranger's house. That's really absurd. But I couldn't say things like that to him. I just could not, you know, make mm-hmm. myself be rude and blunt, especially back in those days. I just had no real voice
of my
own.
And what year was this?
It's about 74.
Okay.
1974.
Yep.
And I was still quite young. It was early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So finally I'm nodding my head. I'm going, oh yes, of course I will be there Tuesday. You know, no worries. This will be fun. I'm patronizing him, just smiling, going, yes, yes. No intentions of ever showing up.
Mm-hmm.
But I did. My curiosity got the best of me, and I actually did something that, you know, went totally against the way I'd been raised. You just don't go off alone into strangers' apartments and hop in strangers' cars. And you know, some of my peers were getting more and more outrageous and hitchhiking. And, you know, that's mm-hmm. hippie days.
Right, right.
And things were getting wilder and wilder. But I just wasn't in that frame of mind at all. So for me, this was a very different, very out of character action to actually show up.
And so you actually went to his house?
I did. And he was there alone for a while and told me a couple of very amusing stories about himself and his studies with his teachers. And there was something about him that was calming, friendly, very humorous, but he was also quite frightening. The kind of energy that he had, this collection of his attention, this power of attention. And when I got to the apartment, he was no longer suffering from palsy. He was no longer feeble. He was quite agile. It was an act.
I see.
It had been a really good act, and he was very good at that.
Mm-hmm.
And he would do things like that often, especially if we were in public. And if I was, in later times, as I got more and more bold, and I would joke with them or talk back, and if we were in public, he would put on this kind of an act to get sympathy from people around. The more people, the better.
Yes, yes.
and do things that were just totally embarrassing.
Quite a playful man, then.
He was very playful.
Uh-huh.
Very playful. It's very typical of their tribe. They're just genuinely happy and playful all the time.
Hmm. And so where was he from?
They're from the eastern side of the Andes, central Andes, not the highland territory where the weather gets drier and
Right. It's
post-Inca kind of cultures, but it's a little bit further down, very, very rough, rough country. A lot of rocky areas, a lot of waterfalls, but it's
sort
also
of the headwaters,
still jungle.
Sort of the headwaters of the Amazon?
I suppose so.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Their tribes had moved away from the main rivers through the centuries. They'd moved back and back and back. And that was to avoid other people who thought very differently than they did. From their own mythologies and their own history that they told me, they believe that they came from a land that sank in the Pacific Ocean. And they referred to it as a sound that's similar to moo, which is typical of a lot of Native Americans, North and South, that they talk about an old motherland off in the West. Some of them have stories where it sank, and others, they just fled.
Mm-hmm. So what did you learn from this man? And his wife was with him also?
We met his wife that day down on the beach. They lived very, very close to the walked down on the beach. There wasn't anybody there. And it was just her walking towards us. And she scared me even more than he did. She was not behaving like a grandma. And here she was this little tiny, stocky, white-haired woman. A lot of wrinkles. And her body was very agile, powerful. There wasn't anything old about the way she carried herself, same with him. And that power of attention, the power, energy of her aura and the focus was just terrifying to me. To me, grandmothers, people with that many wrinkles and that much white hair were people that you had to watch carefully. You didn't let them do things like turn something on the stove by themselves because they'd forget it and leave it and things would start burning. They sit around and sip, tea and watch a lot of TV.
Right. It's very curious to me, though. What is this power of attention you noticed? Can you describe it more fully? It obviously really, really got your attention.
Yeah, and in a very, very big way. I'd never seen, never met anybody like that, never heard of anybody like that. And they, when they look at you, they're looking right through you. They can see everything.
That's the sensation you had.
Oh, yeah. And they proved it through the years that they always were aware of what was going on inside me. There's no point in trying to fear beliefs, actions. It's just no way to surprise them in that way.
How did they come to pick you?
They believed that they were shown signs, in their visions and ceremonies and things of who would be appropriate to teach. A part of their prophecies from their culture, they came from that land that sank. They went into the Americas, South America in particular, lived in the central area for a long time. We're talking about 50, 60, 70,000 years ago. Their oral history talks about things going way, 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 way back like that.
Mm-hmm.
And many thousands of years being in the central area. And then they moved west and finally up into the east side of the Andes. They just kept moving farther and farther, more remote, harder to get to kind of places.
Mm-hmm.
And as different cultures would migrate and travel, and they felt that they were way too different, that they didn't want to interact with them. Maybe they were hostile. They would just move farther back. And their belief is that they were given a job as a culture, as a people, to hold their way of living and thinking, their ceremonies, their whole belief system intact, to keep it untainted, clean, and that someday it would be needed by the rest of the world, that they would have to leave their reclusive hideaway and go out into the rest of the world sharing this gift that they kept intact, their way of living and thinking. And they were given a whole list of signs of when the time came. It would be things like the glaciers melting in the Andes, the rainfall becoming less and less through the Amazon, different species of animals disappearing, certain frogs disappearing. That was a very important. The list just goes on, a bunch of those sorts of things. And when the tribe realized that this was the time, we're in it, that they referred to it as the changing of an era, the ending of one and the beginning of another, that as the prophecies dictated, they would have to select certain elders to go out away from the tribe, go out into other parts of the planet and share their knowledge to try to bring balance back to humanity, back to the planet. So a number of different elders left. D'Amato and Chia Hedica were just two. They were one couple. They went west over the Andes and then up the coast. They stopped in several different places in Central America, Mexico. They were in, of all places, East Los Angeles for a while.
Oh, sure.
And then they went to Santa Cruz. And they'd been there, I don't really know exactly how long, a year or two, before I met them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what did they have to teach you? I mean, was it their mission then to impart the knowledge of their tribe?
Yes. And they felt that it would not be successful if they tried to teach a wide number of people, that there were language barriers, there were experience barriers, and our culture so radically different than theirs. Radically different.
Yeah. My goodness.
They called us the Walking Dead. It's not very complimentary.
Well,
from their point of view, it's quite accurate. They believe that we have developed a way of being, a state of attention and awareness and focus that essentially is like being in a fog, being numbed out, asleep. So, therefore, the walking dead. And the thing that they kept intact was their way of thinking, their way of approaching life. As a human, all of the concepts, the mythologies that go with that, the very center, the basis of all of how they think, what they think, all the ceremonies, everything is based around this concept that they called the song. Now, a song is not something necessarily that's heard. It's a poetic reference, a poetic description of an energy being that exists far beyond the physical body and exists after the physical body dies away. They believe that absolutely everything, excuse me, everything in our universe is alive. Everything, every atom, every subatomic particle, every little bundle of energy, the dirt, the sand, the rocks, the waters, the winds, the stars, planets, galaxies, everything is alive. And because it is alive, it is conscious. It has its own way of thinking. It lives, experiences, it radiates, it emotes, it communicates. Life energy passes through and is used. And so every one of these things is alive. It's an entity. It is a song. We as human beings, our totality, they believe, is much more accurately described in that poetic reference as a song. And that we are as old as our universe. This concept of new souls and old souls and that kind of thing, it's not anything like what they believe in. They really thought things like that were a bit humorous.
Yes, I suppose. Just a moment here, let me. And we're recording just fine. And by the way, the way that I'm going to be editing this is if you have to stop or take a drink of water or whatever, stop what you're saying, take a just a, you know, 1-2 count, and then do whatever you need to do in terms of cough or, you know, because I've got computer editing software that will facilitate my being able to separate those things out. I mean, I can one of the things that I've been able to do is even pull out the uh-huh that, you know, just to go and groom the sound very, very meticulously. So you were speaking about the song, about that everything is alive.
Everything is alive. It's thinking.
And they said
conscious.
That it was humorous to think about old souls and new souls.
Oh, yes. They thought that was a very silly idea. How could there be a birth of a new soul, a new entity, in the way that we think of as a human entity?
Do they think about us as aggregations of consciousness, or?
In a sense, being as old as we are, we've been around for a bit. We've been bouncing through the universe and taking experience, lifetimes, so to speak, in all sorts of different dimensions, forms. We've been all over. We've done things from all kinds of different perspectives. And this is only just one place that we've decided to come and be. From their point of view, we as entities choose to come into a human life or any other kind of experience. We could come to this planet and decide to be a tree or a rock or the waters or, you know, an animal. And they don't see any kind of hierarchy with it. Like in the Hindu traditions where you got to be a rock for a long time first, and then when you're good enough, you get to animal, and you go through all these different animal species. You're finally a cow, and when you're good enough, you get to be human, and if you're bad enough, you have to go back and be a cow again, or if you're really bad, maybe less than a cow. And it's almost like a prison school that you have to be here to do these things, to accomplish certain understanding, certain growth. And you have to be really, really good, you know, goody-two-shoes, following all the rules all the time. Or you come back in your next life, thinking of it in very linear terms, next in the future life, you come back as something less than. From the Hedika's point of view, they have no concepts of this less than and better than. They have no concepts of that kind of hierarchy. They don't have even a word in their language for judgment or condemnation.
Fascinating.
And it makes for a very different way of thinking, an extremely different way of thinking. They think in terms of how things are, how they operate, how they're functioning, if they're efficient, if there's something that you need for a task right now. For instance, if they're out hunting and gathering and they come across a little plant that they know to be poisonous, they might speak to it, they may honor it, and walk on by. They don't. They're not going to be grabbing it, trying to make food of it or tea or medicines or drink. They're not going to rip it out by their roots because it. If they ate it, it would poison them. They don't think less of it because it would poison humans. It's just another living species.
Another being.
Another being. It's a diversity. It's there's no right or wrong to it. They discern.
That's what I was going to ask. Is there a, I mean, because you said that there is a no word for judgment, but I was going to say, is there a capability of discernment?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And that's how they go about observing the world around them. They're observing it to see what's really there and to discern if there's danger, if there's something that's going to be good there for them, something they need, something they're looking for. If they're looking for a particular type of food or a medicine, they don't think of that plant or that animal as being somehow better than that little poisonous plant.
Well, I was going to say that it there's a real undercurrent of honoring.
Honoring everything.
Yeah.
Because everything is alive, everything is a song. They believe that all these different little pieces of aliveness that are hanging out through the universe, that they are all, each, a unique individual piece of Creator. That's the way they see their world and the universe. Everything is a piece of Creator. It's a lot. Every one of these things is extraordinarily different from each other. Some of them are a lot bigger, some are smaller, some do this sort of a thing in life, their life, and other entities do another entirely different thing in their life. For instance, the entity that is the sun, it has a certain kind of job, and it does its sun thing. It's a star.
Right.
And you can't expect it to be doing other kinds of tasks. And there's nothing wrong with what it's doing. It's not better than any other being.
Do they feel that this is all a part, each is a part of a fabric, a
yes.
universal fabric?
And that's where the name for the book comes in, Sacred Link, because each one of these different things is a piece of Creator, the great mystery. Everything is sacred. And everything is linked together in a very, very mysterious way. Linked outside of time and space. So that if we wanted to contact something on the other side of the universe, we can instantaneously with our thought, aiming our thought.
Aiming thought?
Aiming. Collecting, focusing, aiming thought.
Was that
attention.
A lot of what you learned
yes.
from them?
Yes.
I mean, okay.
That's why the feeling of them... which I noticed from the very first moment of meeting them, the focus of their energy, the amount of energy that's in their auric field that is radiating out when they put their attention on you, it's this mountain of attention and energy just beaming, you know, a huge laser just beaming right into you.
Fascinating.
And that... That feels very different than anything that we have in our culture. Very, very different. Scared me to death, but the more I saw it, the more I interacted with it, the more I wanted to have some of it, even if I could learn how to have a little piece of it. And that's why I stayed. But this concept of song, that each thing is valuable, worthy, sacred, has something to contribute in all of existence, and is not a less than or a better than. It's not separate from anything. Unique, individual, completely unique. Nothing else has the same signature. Completely unique.
Even down
but
to the
tied
atoms.
Right down to subatomic particles.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is unique. The amount of awareness, we just don't have words in our language that really address any of this. When we're talking about something like a human or, you know, your pets, your dog, your cat, the flower, we can feel the aliveness. We can feel something individual and unique about them, their intelligence, their beingness. Each entity, even every subatomic particle, has this uniqueness, this intelligence. And we share these things through this mysterious web, the links, the threads of life that move outside of time and space. We share them with everyone, with all beings.
So that's sort of a paradox, though, if something is completely unique and yet linked.
And linked. From a certain perspective, mm-hmm. it would look like a paradox. From their perspective, it is not. We are linked.
In a way, I look at it as the fingers of my hand. Each finger is different, but it's the same hand. Is that a useful analogy?
More like a spider web that has is tied to five different bushes.
Okay.
Five different plants. It doesn't make any of those plants the same being, but they are tied together with the spider web.
Okay.
We're linked.
Tell us about these links.
It's a very different concept than the Hindu Buddhist concepts of everything is one, and that we are working towards melding back into the one and losing all of our individuality. Very Hindu kind of a thought. They don't think that way at all. They believe that the Creator has come into existence in order to experience and to experience diversity. So Creator has divided itself up into as much diversity as it could imagine and continues to do so.
But, I mean, okay, one of the reasons that I came to Santa Cruz was to hopefully, I was able to do it, but not formally, study with Ralph Abraham, who was a proponent of chaos theory. And one of the things that I've learned about chaos theory is multiple layers of scale, yet each layer has infinite detail to it. And there's infinite dimensionality.
Yes.
So that even if you go to the quanta, there are many scales below that and many scales above that. And so, anyway, continue.
That relates more to the way the Hedicas think than anything else in our society.
Really?
If you just change the words around and inserted quantum physics language, they are a lot closer to many of the ideas of quantum physics. And yes, they see our universe as having so many different levels and dimensions and potentials and possibilities going down to the micro.
Right.
And way out into macro in both directions farther than we could ever imagine.
Yes. Yes. So can you tell us about training that our listeners could perhaps continue to do or begin to do in this context of focusing attention?
The very first thing that the Hedicas ever taught me on that first day was what they called the ceremony of finding your own song. And this is a way of training yourself how to collect your attention and focus it, aim it on something of your choosing, and hold it there without distraction. And in this ceremony, obviously you're aiming it at your own song, at your own beingness. So this is an experience. It's not something intellectual. It's not something that you can sit and think about and try to put words to as to what is an entity. You know, what does it mean that it's a living poem? We can intellectualize it, talk about it forever, and never really get there. We talk around it. For them, to really know and understand something, you have to experience it firsthand.
For yourself. And otherwise, it's not meaningful.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's just data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could hear me talk about the experience of feeling my own song and learning, knowing it, doing the ceremony. And I could talk for days about it. And from your perspective, it's just more data. So for them, unless we personally experience something, then we don't have real knowledge and knowingness of it. It's just more data. And one of the things that they see that is take on this data with blind belief. We wholeheartedly suck it up. And as infants, you know, we're trained, listen to mommy, listen to daddy, do as we say, believe everything. And, you know, there's a few good things in there. Don't go in the street. Don't touch it. That it's hot. And yeah, we got to learn that kind of stuff. But we get this impression when we're really tiny that they're all-knowing, that they're infallible, that you know, the information that's coming from the world out there is absolutely 100% real and true. And it describes who we are, what we are, what the world is, what our relationships are, interactions are, what they should be. And we never question it. We never Right. question any of it. And what that carries on through our entire life. And we hear things like, oh, you know, don't believe everything you read in the newspaper. But if you get down to the real nitty-gritty of it, it's written. It's written. We're reading it. We suck it up. And we tend to believe it wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
We tend not to question it. The Hedekas' way of thinking and living starts with this song. They teach their children very, very young about what their own song is, how to feel it, how to experience it. It's the center point of all of their activities, all their ceremonies, all their teachings, everything. And what it boils down to, it's very, very simple. It's very short, deceptively so. And I disregarded it, of course, in my early training, thinking that, oh, this is a very naive, very simple, too short, too easy, couldn't possibly be valuable. So I would go along with the different exercises and ceremonies as they came up as part of the training, but it took me a while to really get it, to grasp what this had to offer. And the basis of it is that they feel that that our entity, our song, has a basic feeling quality. It's a feeling signature that identifies us as a living thing, something that can manifest as a human, that this signature thing, this is something that confuses people in our culture a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand it as a resonance.
A resonance.
A unique
Everything
resonance.
Has unique resonance, a unique signature, and on a very subconscious level, we're using that. We tune into it. We learn to identify things and people with this energy signature.
But unconsciously, mostly in this culture anyway.
Oh, yeah, very unconscious. And for them, it becomes a very conscious and purposeful thing to notice it. And we do a lot more of noticing other signatures. The signature between the different, when we're dreaming, Damano used to use this example of having a dream, and there's three people there. You can't see anything about them, so you don't get any visual clues. You don't see any silhouettes. You don't hear voices. There's nothing there that gives you any normal clues as to who the people are, but you have a knowingness, and you know without any doubts whatsoever that this one is your father, that one's your mother, and that's your best friend.
And it's a beyond a cognitive knowing.
Yeah. In your dream, you are consciously aware mm-hmm. that those are the individual people who are there. Those are the three figures, and you don't have any questions, you don't have any doubts about it. It's very tangible, and there are no other clues. We never stop to think about our own signature and our own feeling quality. So there's this basic feeling experiential-ness about our song, our entity, that we can tune into and experience. And it has a very happy, joyful, fun, loving, exciting nature to it. Those sensations, they believe are not emotions like the other emotions that we cook up and generate in ourselves and feel and emote, radiate, act on. That these are there all the time. This, the more positive feeling states, joy, happiness, delight, excitement, play, passion, love. A good example is falling in love. That sensation. Almost everybody's fallen in love with something or someone. Having a crush on somebody in your school years, falling in love with different people, having relationships with them as an adult, falling in love with a little puppy.
Mm-hmm.
This sensation of falling in love is very delicious. It's sweet. It bubbles up. It's almost like it's effervescent in its happiness. Very, very delightful sensations. Their belief is that this is a constant, that those sensations are the constant feeling, experiential base of what our entity is.
Joyousness.
This joyousness.
Fascinating. Yeah.
And that when we turn our attention into the joy purposefully, we can tune into it. We can explore our own beingness, our own antiquity, our gifts, our purpose in life, everything that has to do with us as a song, as an enormously vast ancient entity.
So that's how we can attend to our own song, is by turning into the joyousness?
Yes, but with a different knowing and understanding. In our culture, in our modern culture, we're trained not to be too happy, and especially not for too long.
And, yes.
And anybody who is suspect. You go into the corporate business place, somebody who's just grinning all the time or laughing, and they're just bubbling and happy and joyful, smiling at people. We're thinking that they're sniffing or sipping in the back room,
mm-hmm.
that there's something wrong there.
Well, I think I seem to remember that it was even one of, one of David's wives who came down on him to say, "You shouldn't be dancing in front of the altar." You know, well, wait a minute, who's to say that we cannot be joyous in communion with spirit, but that's really what you're talking about,
exactly.
is turning into the joyousness.
Yes,
and perhaps and dance is actually an intrinsic part of it.
Dance and music gets you there fast. It's another way to find the feelings of joy, aliveness, peace, satisfaction. Excitement about something is through your favorite music or dance, movement. It'll get you there very fast.
So,
but in our culture, we're trained to ignore the truth about these sensations. We're trained to give the power away. For instance, falling in love.
Oh, right.
You got this big, juicy excitement bubbling up. It just feels good from your toes and the bottom of your gut and all the way up in your throat and your head. And you're just overflowing with good, luscious feeling. And we blame it on somebody else. We give the power of it away to this whoever this was that initiated this falling in love feeling in us. And it really, it's not the other person. They're not responsible. Something about the person or the puppy, whatever it was, caused you to scrape aside your own asleepness, your own programming, this programming from society that keeps us in this fog. Scrape it aside long enough so that the feeling sensation of your beingness bubbles up into your conscious awareness. You experience it. But in our society, we don't really know what it is. We name it something else, and we blame it, give credit somewhere else.
It's projected externally.
Yes.
So how do we turn our attention into this joyousness? I mean, what are the first exercises that our listeners could do to continually attend and focus on this ongoing effervescence is what you're talking about.
Well put. I like that. Can I borrow it?
Certainly. Absolutely.
Ongoing effervescence. I love it. In the ceremony that they taught me, they had me think of a moment in my life, which could have happened today, it could have happened years back or in childhood, something where I remembered something joyful and fun, happy, falling in love, any one of those kinds of moments. And it could be a very little, a small, short, passing kind of thing, like seeing a flower where you didn't expect to see one and it just caught your breath. Or that sunset, it's only there for that minute, but whoa. And it just sends that thrill through your body. We think of that moment, and we bring back as much of the memory as we can. Who was there around us? What was there? Sounds, smells.
But very importantly, feeling.
And then you get to the feeling.
Oh, okay.
Very often the way we are trained to think, all these kind of things are woven together in our memory. They're tied together. And we tend to think in our culture of the feeling last.
Right. It's one of the things that's the least conscious. It's true.
Yeah. Or we suppressed it. Happy feeling, bad feeling doesn't really matter. We suppress those things. We suppress the memories of them. Very often I have students that say, I can't think of a happy moment. And even trying to counsel them to remember that little sunset or somebody that said something funny or happy in the store just in passing and you felt delighted for a moment. Tasting some great dessert, your
right.
favorite food, listening to your most favorite music of all time.
Right.
Our society suppresses the feeling states, especially these really good, juicy, happy ones, and limits the amount of time that we're supposed to be engaging in them. And that's because if we really did it for a long time, even if we weren't aware that that's the feeling of our own beingness, our true identity, that we discover it. We discover our own song. We experience it through these happy sensations.
So is that the discovery of one's own song?
Yes.
Is what your feeling is?
It's that. It's the most specifically those happy feelings, because the basic feeling state of our entity, of our song, constantly, 24 hours a day, every day, is this the happy, loving qualities.
Right.
It's constantly there. So it's easy to find the details of your own song, your own beingness, by that route.
You
can take some other routes. I asked Damano one time if he had ever gone to war, and they're a very peaceful people, but he said yes, he had. And I had just had a very grueling experience in a cave, in a spirit journey, where my body was burnt to nothing. And I experienced every speck of it, and the pain and the loss. And it was just, it's horrific. But in the middle of it, I could feel my song, and I could feel it getting louder and louder and louder in my awareness. And I thought that was really peculiar, because here I'm thinking and feeling, experiencing the worst things in my life. You know, everything that ever went wrong, all the bad things, the regrets, the unfinished stuff, leaving my kids. I'm dying. I'm literally dying, and I don't want to. And it's a horrific state, horrific experience of this moving on. But in the middle of it, there was the song. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, am I some kind of a pervert that I would get this joyous, happy, exciting, alive feeling in the middle of all this disgusting, horrible state of everything that was ever bad in my life came rushing to the forefront of my consciousness, my memory. And he said, no, that's one of the great truths, the great mysteries, is that in the depths of things that are the most horrible, the most awful, being at war, attacking people attacking you, you're getting hacked and slashed, you have to maim somebody, kill somebody, that one song is extremely present, very, very loud. The feeling of your own aliveness is extremely intense. And there's a great pleasure there. So there is a pleasure of the song in the midst of the horror. And it can be very, very confusing to people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the easiest route to find or understand one song or to experience. And it can be very, very confusing to people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the easiest route to find or understand one song or to experience it or explore it. But it does put a whole different light on people who get stuck in misery, in abuse, in abusive situations, in war. In the Vietnam War, I remember a lot of my male peers, friends, that went off to war. Some of them not coming back, and those that did, talking about signing up again, volunteering again to go in, going back 3-4 times, being in the middle of it, right in the middle of all of this, the worst of the worst of things that you could think of.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no way to explain it.
But they felt so vital.
They felt vital.
Right at the edge of death.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You feel your aliveness comes to the forefront. Knowing, experiencing exactly what your aliveness is, what it's all about.
But that's also the key and the focus, and we're running a little bit short on time here. That's the key and the focus of the training about feeling one's own song. And it can be done by the focus of one's attention, not necessarily having to associate that with an experience of negativity, although that certainly does throw it into some extraordinary relief,
yeah,
you know, and contrast.
But I'm also, so once you feel the song, then about your book, about what is this web? Can you tell us about the web and the linkage about the songs?
Once you feel your own song, you feel this joy and you know this time, you realize that this is the true feeling experience of you, your own entity. This is your true identity, that you can explore it to find out everything about who you are and where you've been, what knowledge you've collected, what the universe is all about. It's all stored in there. All of those experiences through all the eons is in there, and we can retrieve it consciously. Once we are exploring our own song and we're getting to feel and know that signature, then you can't help but to notice that there is an equally grand song, sacred, wondrous, huge, ancient, beautiful, in everybody, in everything, in every grain of sand, the waters, the winds, everything around you. Yeah. Is alive and conscious and thinking. It is a song of its own. It is radiating out all these things that are a part of its beingness and its experience and its own thoughts, so to speak. And we can perceive all of that, and we can tune into song to song, to other humans, to plants, to animals, the rocks, the land, the waters, winds, the planet, star, other stars, any of it that you want to tune into and interact with in a very experiential way and come to understand what it's all about in terms of something like quantum physics. And wanting to understand subatomic particles, what they are, how they exist, what do they do in existence? What is their job?
Right.
What kind of information do they hold? How do they share it? Where do they go when they disappear out of our visual universe? And where right. have they been when they come pop back in?
Mm-hmm.
And what is all that? We can turn our consciousness purposefully, collecting it, focusing it, which starts with focusing it on our own song, because that's the center place. That's the place of clarity. They used to say that when we are in that feeling state of our own song, we are in our own driver's seat. And when we're not in our song, right. then society's programming is in our driver's seat.
Right.
They called society's programming or masks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you're either in your masks or you're in your song.
So when and you're... Go ahead.
This song awareness state, this being in your own driver's seat, is the same as being at the center of the world, sitting at the tree of life at the center of the world, being on the mountain that's at the center of the world, drinking from the fountain of youth at the center of the world. All those symbols, those metaphors that are in all the different cultures around the planet are saying the same thing. That means being in your song, feeling it, knowing it, understanding what it is you're feeling, and being able to hold that awareness. That becomes your base, your frame of reference for everything. You're feeling and being your song 24 hours a day. That's how they live. That's how the Hedikas live.
Right.
They're living in that song awareness state all the time. So they're in their driver's seat all the time. And they don't take on the kind of programming and blind beliefs mm-hmm. and these masks that they see us drowning in. We're encased in these thought forms, these masks.
And yet that encasement is really by each person's individual choice,
yes.
in my opinion.
Yes, it
so
is.
When you are in the center of the song, then you can attend to the resonances that happen between your song and other songs. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. Yes, and you can't
tell
help
us more
but
about
to
that.
Notice the sacredness and the exquisiteness of all these other songs, and as soon as you turn your attention and you aim it, then you are engaging song to song with another entity, another being.
And there's a third song that shows up then, is that right? But from your two songs?
From one perspective, yes. In the interaction.
Yes.
There's energy exchanged, there's information exchanged, and that creates a thought form. And the thought form, it's a bundle of energy. It has content. It has aliveness. It is a living thing in its own right. And so at that time, then, yeah, there's another song. Mm-hmm.
So we're just about done here. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us. So we have an idea about how to attend to our own song, and then about how to attend to the web. So what else would you would the energies that come through the Hedikas to speak through you? What would they have us know?
They believe that we are at this place in time where what we have known as our culture is ending. It's dying off, and we are about to begin a new way, a new era, new culture. Some tribes refer to it as a new world. They believe that this culture that we're familiar with, our modern culture, is actually many, many, many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years old, that it has come from people off-planet that came here, that didn't have very good intentions, engineered us as a slave population, and taught us how to blindly believe, how to consider them as gods, deities, all-powerful, all-knowing, and we shouldn't question. Shouldn't question anything, just do as we're told and go about little happy servant lives. And we carry all those instructions up to the present time. That is the major component of our society. And it's taught from, you know, parents to children. We're taught how to turn our attention away from our song, how to bury it, hide it, deny it, how to create this fog, this numbing package of energy, thought form, this propaganda that they refer to as our masks, how to create it for ourselves. We tend to copy our parents, get a little Xerox of their masks, and then refine them as we go through life. But they end up being in our driver's seat.
Right.
This society's programming is in our driver's seat, and we're running on a kind of automatic pilot. We give the thought forms all those instructions way back when we were tiny and learning how to create them for ourselves. We fill them with instructions of how to be, all the shoulds, all those beliefs, right, all the blind beliefs, and everything is run according to that structure, to that data that we're hanging on to. As long as we hang on to all of those ideas, web.
And then what of the new world?
The new world, they describe the old world as a backwards turning wheel.
Okay.
And the new world is the frontwards turning wheel. We have a culture based on, you know, yin-yang energies. One takes things apart, one builds things. Our culture is based solely on the backwards turning energy, and it can do only one thing: destroy. It takes things apart. And so that's what our culture has been doing, and we've been exploring all the diversities and possibilities of backwards turning wheels for many, many, many eons, many centuries now. And from the point of view of the spiritual levels of humanity, we're finished playing in that sandbox. We're done.
So what's going to happen in the forward turning wheel?
We've chose to create the opposite, mm-hmm. to create a world based on that collecting together, building, balancing energy, the forwards turning wheel. And that kind of a culture would be song-based. It would be a culture where people would be awake and in their own driver's seat and not asleep. There would be equality. There would be honoring and respect between all people, all things, even
all
the
energy.
Dirt.
Yes.
You know, and the waters and the air and the mm-hmm. everything. Respect, honoring, caring. Doesn't mean we won't have things like technology.
Right.
Technology is not a bad thing by itself. Chosen technologies and methodologies that run at the expense of something else.
Right.
It destroys something else in its process. And we'll figure out how to do all the things that we want to do without having it be at the expense of someone or something else. A culture based on song to song with all of attention to this honoring and this beauty and this equality. Very, very different world than what we have known in our lives. And we're at the place where the old one is ending, the new one is beginning, this last one is, the wheel is turning around and it tears everything apart as it turns, itself included, and it's doing its last thump and bump. As it falls apart, we cannot be tempted to pick up the pieces of the old wheel and try to shove them together in some new way and try to create a new thing from that, because it won't work. It's all the wrong vibrations. It's the wrong patterns. It's the wrong ideas. It's all still backwards turning energy. We have to create it from scratch, something absolutely brand new, something that we have not experienced here on this planet to any degree outside of very small, remote tribes.
But it's always been there.
Just like the yin-yang symbol. Mm-hmm. There's the little dot of the other color
right.
in the body on each side. So, yeah, it's always been there. It's always existed. We don't have conscious examples. The Hedikas tried to bring at least some example of what it could be. Mm-hmm. But this is the bridge time.
Right.
And we are the bridge people. The Hedikas called us the bridge people. And we are the ones who have to dream up the dream of creating the new world. What is it we want? What do we want in a society? What do we want in a personal, intimate relationship with another person? What do we want a family to look like? Mm-hmm. Our social groups and communities to look like? What do we want our businesses to look like, our whole, the economics of our new society? What is it going to look like? How do we want that to be? We have to dream it. We have to think it up and perfect that picture and then act on it.
Again, it's the focus, the deliberate focus of the attention on that feeling song. I
yes.
think that's, but when that's done, you're other than caught by the language, you know, and I think that's a wonderful thing. Any final words before we're done? Because we have to stop. I'm so sorry. I could talk with you about this for hours.
The first book, The Reluctant Shaman, describes the first 3 years of my apprenticeship with D'Amato and Chia Hedika, and it describes all the basic ceremonies, the song ceremony. It's written out there. People can follow it from those descriptions. The same with their life energy openings ceremony is written out in the first book. The second book focuses on the senses and the sexuality, and most specifically women's sexuality, because in destroying a culture and getting people to be subservient, the very first thing that has to be done, you have to eliminate the wise older women, the knowledge carriers, and you have to take the sexuality away from the women. You have to demean it and diminish it and steal their sexual place, their sexual pleasure. And once you do that, the culture is gone. And they are a diminished people. They will be subservient. And you can look all over the planet as this modern Western culture has marched its way from one direction right. to another. You see the same tactics. There's a lot of activity in the physical violence and war and you know, purposefully bombing and murdering and that sort of thing. But if you want to have some of the population left to do things for you, you have to change the way they think. Chia used to say they use poison words, poison ideas to change the way people think and turn them from being a full people, individuals with integrity and purpose in life to subservience, to diminished people who do not believe in themselves or anything else.
But every person makes that choice, and they can also know that they can re-choose.
Yes. And choosing your song is something that you choose every moment. Every moment of the day. You can either choose to let those masks be in your driver's seat and run the show, and you're running on your addiction to that automatic pilot, or you choose purposefully to turn your attention back into the feeling state of your own song, getting back to the place where we're born that way. We have a memory of it. It's deep, it's buried, but it's there, and we can retrieve it, and we can get back to the state where we end up using a lot less energy being in our song 24 hours a day. When we're trying to bury and hide our natural way of being, you spend a lot of energy doing that. A lot.
And we can learn so much from little children who have not known, who have not become very skillful yet with the hypnosis of culture.
Yes.
So we have to stop. Thank you so much, Kay. And I've been talking with Kay Cordell Whitaker, and she has a new book called The Sacred Link, Joining Fortunes with the Unknown. And she also has another book called, her first book is called The Reluctant Shaman. And who are the publishers for these books?
Harper San Francisco published the first one, The Reluctant Shaman. And the Writers Collective has published Sacred Link.
Okay. And are they available through like Borders and Amazon and...
All the stores.
Okay.
All the stores online, even our own website.
And you have a website?
Yes.
And what is your website?
You can get to it by sacredlink.com.
As one word.
It's one word.
Okay.
Or World Balance as one word, worldbalance.com.
Uh-huh. Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Kay.
It's been an honor.
I've been speaking to Kay Cordell Whitaker. We'd like to thank you for joining us.